which would have been the first Christmas as the Renfrew Museum and Park. We did not have a visitor center, and so we had to clear the gallery out to put the Elizabethan Recorder Concert in the gallery. And it met with a great deal of favor. It was difficult to get everybody through the museum to really get a full appreciation of the Elizabethan Recorder Consort because of the limited amount of space we had and the amount of people that we had playing, because the room was pretty much full of all the people that's playing their instruments, and of all varied sizes. I had never really heard of them, and or never heard them until that time. And that's been a favorite group because they have been with us every year since 1975. And now, of course, it's expanded into having different groups come in and at different periods of time. And now the Christmas open house is 2 days versus 1 day back in the early beginning of the museum. And I don't recall the numbers of people that went through, but it seems to me that our first open house that we had at Christmas time, we attracted like 500 to 800 people, but that's merely a guess. And I don't think we've ever had more than 1,000 at any one time go through, which is basically about the limit that you can get through the museum in that period of time. But it was very much a success and has been really something that people look forward to each year since. Pause.
How about the Mother's Day open house that I found listed in the minutes for 1976? Is this a tradition that's been going on?
Well, the initial, the first Mother's Day open house that we had was, again, developed and organized with the help of John Deemer, our curator, and Mary Jane Meller and Blanche Newcart. And the thought of having an open house to get people to come to the museum at no charge. Nobody would be charged. Mothers were given a carnation when they came to the museum with their families. And always remember, the carnations were donated by Green Arbor. And I'm not sure how many years we did that year after year, but I would think that would have been at least 4 years, because in 1976 would have been the first year, 76, 77, 78, 79. So there was at least 4 years, and I know that the next year, I'm not sure whether it was held again or whether it stopped at that point in time, and it was picked up again, but I don't remember the year that it was picked up. It was an annual event for about 4 years. I'm going to pause. The Fish for Fun, I guess, was one of my brainstorms. Fishing, I felt, had to be permitted. From the standpoint that Miss Nicodemus always allowed fishing on the stream. Never allowed hunting, but fishing was a yes. And she always wanted fishing to be at Renfrew. And the reason back of that, I'm sure, was because her father was such an avid fisherman. And she again remembered coming along with her father. He went fishing and they played in the stream. But I opposed regular trout fishing because of the kind of fishermen that just are normal trout fishermen are not really respecters of the land. And at that point in time, we said, well, why don't we go to the Fish Commission and see whether this stream can be adapted for fish for fun.
Barbara's Hooks, sir.
Yes, Barbara's Hooks, catch all you want, but you have to put them all back. And one of the members of the board, Pat Presler, who was on the board, was an avid sportsman. And he got the information, and we went to those people, and they came down, looked at the stream, and said, very suitable, and it's large enough to support fish for fun. And so it was initiated several years after. I don't remember what period of time went by before we had fish for fun. And we had trophy fish, of course, it was put in large fish. And after a couple years of that, they decided that larger fish couldn't survive during the hot summer months. So then they reduced the size and they changed the rules, saying that first you could take one fish, but it had to be 20 inches or longer. Then they changed it now to you can fish and catch as many fish as you want, but you can only keep three fish 9 inches or longer. But that remains the same. Fish for fun, and they stock the stream two or three times each spring, and that has been one of the best things that we've ever done. These are truly caring sportsmen. They don't drop anything along the stream. They pick up after other people, in fact. And so it has been a blessing to have fish for fun in the stream at Renfrew. We have about a half a mile of stream where we allow fish for fun.
So you periodically weed out your adult fish by allowing them to keep up to three.
Yes. And by the time, you know,
they're not going to live anyway.
No. And basically, they stock it with brown trout, which has a tendency not to move a great deal. They'll stay in one area more so than rainbow or brooks. And so they basically stock with brown trout. And sometimes they'll put in some albinos, which is fascinating for people to watch and try to catch them. So it's, but I think in a year's time, the amount of fish that's caught and kept, they're pretty much, the larger fish are pretty much weeded out on a yearly basis. They'll stock the stream, usually stock the stream the first week in March, and then again towards the end of March or April, and they'll stock it as many as three times a year, but mostly twice a year.
I have a friend who cannot stand people who follow the docking trucks.
Oh boy.
And he every year he rails, I can't stand these people. It's terrible, but they're the least sportsmanlike fisher, because the stockfish don't know anything. They're
very
unlearned.
They're very gullible.
Yeah.
You know?
And
Steve Gavalchek was there to study the stream and to do a lot of the survey work that what we ought to be doing in the future to maintain a healthy stream, to maintain the stream banks. And he and I worked closely together because at that period of time we was doing some stabilization of the stream banks and how to propose to keep the Antietam Creek within its boundaries without changing or altering the course of the stream. And all of these things was relatively new to me when they talked about using gabions and baskets with stones in them. And of course I had to ask the question, what the world is a gabion? And all they are is baskets filled with stones, fill them by hand and put them along the stream bank and let them.
They're at Chambersburg,
right?
Bridge there by the old fort. That's their old gabions.
And the first, this would have been within the first couple years of Renfrew, we had the area where you go back to the Fongstock property had eroded away to the point that you could hardly get back past the creek to go to the Fongstock house because it eroded that bank away. And then when I studied more about these gabions, I thought, gee, this seems to be the way to go, because we can put those baskets in, out in the stream, and then build up behind it and save our driveway. And we did that with the help of...
Should this be recorded?
It is being recorded. So we did, with the help of Burr employees, we filled these baskets in a stretch of the stream about 200 feet long. We stacked these wire baskets called gabions, a wire mattress on the bottom filled with stone, and then stacked these wire baskets up on top of each other. All done by hand. It was a physical, hard job, but we stabilized about 200, 225 feet of the west bank on the Antietam, which now permits us to utilize the driveway back to the Fahnestock house with any fear that it's going to fall into the creek. And to go back to Steve Kowalczyk, he was here like an intern doing this for part of his thesis for his education. And we have a copy of his report. He was there one summer and really gave us a lot of information, some of the guidelines of what we ought to continue to do. And that report has a great deal of information on it, and that is on file at the museum.
Do you use local stone, or do you use floating stone?
No, you know, I can't remember where he's from, and I'm not sure. Jim?
He was from Indiana University.
Yes.
Yeah,
of Pennsylvania.
Which one? Pennsylvania
University. Okay. I remember reading it sometimes.
Right. Did you see his report?
No, I haven't.
There is a report on Fow at the museum that tells pretty much what he did. And he was involved in more than just the stream. He was involved in the aesthetics of the whole park. And that's all compiled in his report, his final report. And gave us a lot of valuable information that probably most of us would never thought of. And I thought he was very thorough with his report.
Has there been much of a problem with keeping, I don't know the term, keeping the stream sweep, keeping it pure?
Well, yes, there's always, our biggest problem now is with all the building upstream ahead of us. Flooding is more of a problem now than ever before. The restrictions that you have in maintaining the stream bank, you're very limited to what you can do. And I would think runoff water is our biggest factor with fish. Now, we did take, this would have happened about 7-8 years ago, before we changed the rules and regulations for the fish for fun, before we stopped putting the real large fish in. They made a study of the stream. Fish Commission came down and shocked the fish, shocked the stream to find out how many different varieties of fish were there at the time. And I'll never forget, I was with them. They had this little boat where they walked alongside it and pushed it upstream, and had this battery in, and they'd stick these probes in the stream and shock it. And it would bring all the fish life, the aquatic life, up to the surface. And I never knew there was so many different varieties of fish. And in fact, they even brought up a little eel, which to me should not have been in that stream.
Freshwater eel.
At all. Although years ago there was eel, but now they migrate so far to have their young. And I was really shocked when this eel came up. It was about 18 inches long. But many different varieties. And they did a very thorough study on the stream. And the quality of the water at that time was good. Now, again, I'm sure if we took the same test now, the quality of the water would not be as good as it was back then.
I was thinking of the farm runoffs and things along the line.
Right. Well, I guess being a farmer, I sort of defend their position a little bit. I think that the mixture of the runoff water mixing with the farm runoff, yes, it all contributes to a poor quality of water, and that's too bad.
Now, when we came here in the 60s, that there had been drought, and I remember Betsy and the drought years, and all of a sudden it changed. Mm-hmm. And I would guess this year you don't really have a drought problem. You have a pretty good flow now.
No, the stream flow is as good or better than I've seen it for 3-4 years. We have the water table, I would think, would be up almost to par. And I say that because I can always tell when the water table is high, because after we have an inch or two of rain over a 24-hour period of time, the water comes up in the basement of the museum. And that's my guideline for knowing when the water table's up pretty near the top. If it rains, it pushes the water right up through the concrete floor. There's a little area back in the front basement area, a little pinhole, and it'll shoot up about that high just from the pressure building up under that concrete slab. And the museum sets rather high, so you look at that and say, boy, and it's good because our water table should be as good or better than it's been for many years. Well, Mrs. Nicodemus had several loves. Her greatest love was golfing. Her second love was playing bridge. And her third love, and I'm not sure this is in the right category, but cats played a very important part of her life. When I moved there in 1952, she had 16 cats. And most of those cats were not, they didn't have papers, they were just common, ordinary cats. She had one Siamese, a Blue Point Siamese, but as far as having registered cats or pedigree cats, no, she did not have. As I said, 16 cats there when I first moved there. She had as high as 22. The cats were all fed in the kitchen. They all had living quarters in the boiler room of the museum, of the house, their house at that time. I always had to be careful. I don't call it Renfrew Museum before it was Renfrew yeah. Museum. So in 1952, it was the Nicodemus house. And there was 16 cats living there, and they all had their separate places. You have to look at my garage door sometime. I recorded when they died and how they died and where they was buried. I don't have them all there, but I have the large majority of them recorded. And Miss Nicodemus was very meticulous how those cats were fed. This one could not have this or this or this. But we bought cat food by the case. And each one had his little separate dish. And needless to say, you know, somebody would say, 16 cats in the house? How did you keep it clean? Well, you know, surprisingly enough, yes, it made a lot of work, but we had a surprisingly clean kitchen. That was because I scrubbed it often on my hands and knees. That was my role. And the boiler room, which was a hot water system, was covered with chicken wire and then asbestos put over it, which is a no-no today. And each year we would have to recoat the furnace with this asbestos insulation. And the reason for that, these cats would sleep on top of the furnace. In order to get to the top of the furnace, they had to stand on the floor, jump up, put their feet in the asbestos and go up on top of the furnace. So by the time spring came around, it was down to the chicken wire and you had to recoat it. And Bill Adams, of course, was, you had to know Bill Adams to appreciate this one. He would always say, well, it looks like it's the annual time to come out and do the furnace at the Nicodemus, is because the cats had scratched all the asbestos off. But she had them all named. Every cat was named, and all the cats had to be treated so-and-so. We took them to the vet on a regular basis. They had to get their teeth cleaned, and we'd have to do all of these things with them. And most of her cats had some kind of an ailment. One that came along that was called Mr. Royer, and that was called after Earl Royer, who was the carpenter that did most of the work for them when they renovated. This big gray and white cat, and he apparently had glaucoma, and one of the eyeballs just literally exploded. But he healed up, had one good eye, lived a full life even after that. And I don't remember if the doctor said it was glaucoma, it was something similar to glaucoma where the pressure just exploded the eye. And some of them with part of their tail was cut off, one with part of their foot off. But there was none of them that you could really call healthy, healthy cats. The nice thing about it, though, she would always have them spayed, so there was no new kittens. It was just new cats. We never had kittens, but there was always a new cat that came by, and if it was stayed around long, she had it in the house and was feeding it. And so I learned to like cats also. It made a lot of extra work, but I always felt this way. If someone loves animals that well, then you do the best you can to maintain them. The last cat that Mrs. Nicodemus had, as they died off, there was no new cats came on the scene. So when Mrs. Nicodemus died in 1973, she had one cat left. This was a cat that came from a stray that had kittens up in the barn. The cat's mother was killed on the highway. She had been run over, not killed, ran over with a car, mangled so badly that there was no way of saving her, and I had to shoot the cat. And I could not get close enough to pick her up to take her to the vet. She was really wild. And after I shot her, I looked and I thought, well, I knew she was going to have kittens because I had seen her around. But I looked at her and she was so mangled I couldn't tell whether she'd had the kittens or not. But I looked at her breast to see whether she was nursing, and it didn't look like she had been nursing, so I forgot about it. 3 days later, I had picked up two stray pups, which I was keeping in the barn until they got big enough that I could give them to someone. I went out and here was this little gray puffball of a kitten in with these pups. And Mrs. Nicodemus was away at the time. The eyes were open, so the cat was at least 2 weeks old, this kitten. I took the cat in, fixed up a box, prepared Mrs. Nicodemus for her newest addition, and put a little kitty litter in the corner, and she came in, and of course, it was a gray, completely gray cat. And she went, she said, oh, where did you find this beautiful little kitten? She fell in love with it. We had it potty trained in less than a day at two weeks old, you know. She went to this little pot of kitty litter, and that was housebroken. And for 17 years, this cat would have been not much over a year old when this Nicodemus died. And then I took care of it for the rest of its life and wound up running over the cat with my car and killed it. Accidentally, I might say. But he'd come to my house every night for milk, which I would give him milk. And I thought he went back over to the furnace room. And I got in my car, backed up, and I heard this thump, and then another thump, and I ran over both my rear and front wheel. The cat jumped up, ran over underneath my other car. And I thought, it can't be possible, this cat, I would survive that. And I felt so bad. I got the cat out from under the car and stayed with it to die 10 minutes later. That was a heartbreaker. And of course, the cat was 17 years old, and I'm sure what happened, the cat was hard of hearing, didn't hear me start up. But we gave it a good burial. It's buried down at the Antietam Humane Society in their little pet cemetery.
The cat's name was Holly?
Holly. The cat...
Two of ours are deaf, so all of them are deaf, though.
Well, did Holly have a chance to be in the museum after it was turned into a museum? Is that where she lived?
Yes. She stayed, not in the museum house itself, but stayed in the basement in the boiler room as we kept, where the cats all stayed at night. And I would let this cat up in the house. If I was there, I'd leave the cat up in the house. And the cat would go directly up to Mrs. Nicodemus's bedroom. It's crazy how this cat would always go and would knead, you know, the pillow, you know, like they always do. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Miller.
Well, my